Hey everybody, this is John Fusco, and you're listening to the No Film School podcast. Welcome to what will most likely be the third and final episode of our Best of 2017 series. Honestly, we could keep this going forever with the quality of advice we received over the course of our interviews last year, but we're soon to get a whole bunch more at Sundance next week to kick off our season for 2018. All of the episodes featured in this week's volume are part of what we here at No Film School like to call roundtable episodes. We'll try to get at least one or two of these done at every festival we travel to. The idea is really to get a group of filmmakers together and have them discuss their craft in a forum where everyone can relate to each other and build off their experiences. A lot of times, they'll be fresh off seeing each other's work, so the questions keep flying and lead to some fantastic stories. We've selected three of these episodes to feature today, and it's worth noting that each of them ended up being among our most popular episodes of 2017. For those of you making short films, these clips should be especially helpful. The episodes are titled, What It Takes to Get Your Short into Sundance, How to Get Your Midnight Shorts into South by Southwest, and DP Roundtable, The Shots That Almost Killed Us. First off, we're going to hear excerpts from a lively discussion I led in Austin last year with a number of filmmakers that had just finished up their screenings at South by Southwest, a festival that can only be referred to as a midnight movie mecca. Among the participants are the dynamic duo of Celine Held and Logan George, who came to the festival with Mouse, producer Sarah Winchall of Whiskey Fist, and director Drew Maynard and cinematographer Caleb Dirks from Thesaurus. Take a listen. What did you do to get yourself into the position where your film is now being exhibited at South by Southwest?
I don't know.
Great question.
So my director, or the director of Whiskey Fist, Jillian Horvat, had a short 2 years ago in the Midnights as well. And so, you know, I loved it. And so...
Is there some sort of a legacy, would you say, within South
by? I
would say South
so. By? Well, like... I mean, her short, it's her first short is Kiss Kiss Finger Bang, which is, you can see it on Fandor, and it's a great movie. And I mean, you know, she made this, we made this one together, Whiskey Fist, and we didn't know it was going to happen. I mean, it's not like, oh, well, we're definitely getting in, but it was like she'd been here and she loved it so much that I know that it's really important to us to be here. So, I mean, I don't know how we did it, but we got lucky and did it.
For Logan and I, we made three shorts last year in 2016, Mouse being one of them. Logan and I have been writing a feature script for 6 years altogether, 3 years, just the two of us. We wanted to make shorts to prove we could make our feature. Essentially, if you take our three shorts and you put them in a pot, mix them together, and you pull out what that is, that would be our feature. So that was kind of, if you're a witch, and you can do that.
And our DP had shorts in South By before. Like, that's maybe an element of it. And I was also an actor in a short that was in South the Midnight Shorts the year prior. Mm-hmm. Maybe hand in hand with that.
This is our first time at South By, and I'd say what ultimately started our path here was Caleb and I met in L.A. at film school, if that's okay.
Fine.
It was a semester. It was only a semester long.
I had Jillian at film school, too. Okay.
But I would say once we graduated college, Caleb moved to Nashville, and we started just making stuff, and that's where we, no shade on the film school, that's where we learned most of our stuff was just making stuff on our own. And we, you know, stories changed and evolved, and we learned what works and what doesn't, and ended up screening in Nashville last year and this year. And so just thought, okay, cool. People are responding positively, and I guess we'll toss one in on South By. I don't know if Caleb has more to...
My confidence is a little bit bigger now.
Yeah. No, we just kept making things we wanted to. And it was like, if an idea hit that it's like, that'll only take 2 hours to make, let's do that. Okay. Mm-hmm. It worked. Cool. And so you just keep going on it until it really clicks.
As a producer, I've made four shorts this year, and you know, it's like, you don't know what is going to do what where. So like, Whiskey Fist is here at South By, and that's amazing. And, you know, I have other shorts playing at other festivals, and it's just sort of like, you know, as a producer, my directors come and they say, well, will we get in here or will we get in there? And it's like, I could pretend that I know, but it's like, really, you can't, it's just so hard to guess how that's going to hash out.
So then none of you would say that you made a movie to try and get into the Midnight's portion of a festival.
Definitely not. I mean, and I also think, to piggyback off of what you guys said a little while ago, that we're just making shit we want to make.
Yeah.
Like, we're just doing stuff. And I think to make a short to try to get into a festival is totally the wrong way to go about it. Mm. We're first time filmmakers. This is
right.
Yeah.
Nice.
So, yeah.
Get you know out.
That? The three shorts we made last year are the first shorts we've ever made.
Oh man.
So then technically speaking, like in terms of, you know, not, you don't have to give us your budgets, but like, what did you do to sort of put yourself in the position to have the resources to make the film that you were trying to make?
I have some very supportive parents, and they allowed us to shoot at the where we shot The Source. It's kind of a lake house setting. That was big, and I don't know, you know, you can't put a dollar amount on that, but also just utilizing resources, friends, and kind of a favor, work on mine, work on yours, scratch my back sort of deal.
Very expensive in the scratch realm. Actually, there were a lot of back scratches going on.
A lot of butt scratches.
Yeah, a lot of butt scratches. That's perfect. But yeah, I think the location also kind of inspired in a sense. And man, locations can give you so much. I do agree. And then just having absolutely amazing friends who give up time and their passions.
Big shout out to our actor who was kind enough to volunteer, and we've worked with him on stuff.
He's really good.
He's amazing.
Yeah, he's hilarious.
Tennis instructional videos, and we've worked with him on those. They're great. Check out Tennis Tips with Freddie Love. And so he was all about it. He believed in the script, luckily, and was just like, yeah, let's hang out for a weekend and make this thing.
For Whiskey Fist, Jillian's first film landed at Fandor after playing here at South By a couple years ago. And she got, she's not here to talk about it, but she got the Fandor Fix Filmmaker title. And what they did at Fandor, which is so amazing, is basically we ran a Kickstarter last year, and they were like able to help fill that out. And then we will, if you want to see Whiskey Fist and you're patient, it will be on Fandor once we're done with our festival runs.
So can I ask, how does something land at Fandor?
I don't know. I didn't work on Kiss Kiss Finger Bang, and I don't know how, but I think they liked it. I know that much. And I know Fandor, something I do know about Fandor is that they're a big supporter of shorts, and they're one of the few places that are interested in new shorts. So it is a good resource, especially if you're interested in seeing shorts. It's a good place to go.
Could prospective filmmakers like reach out to Fandor and ask them to help fund their short? Is that something that
I
they
hope
do?
So I'm trying to do that myself.
Yeah.
So
I saw that actually on the like how it was produced by Fandor, and yeah. I was wondering. Like,
yeah. No. I mean, and you know, Fandor's actually had some change in staff since we started. So you know, I as a producer, I'm also just like doing what probably a lot of the listeners are doing, which is like trying to find an email address and pitching them my next few shorts to see if they'll be interested. But so far I'm not sure. And if I find out, maybe I'll like comment on this post or something.
Yeah. Follow up with
keep
us.
Keep you guys posted. Yeah.
And then you two, I mean, like you just did three shorts last year, and I know you two, and I know you're very like disciplined people as far as like getting stuff done, like scheduling out like what you need exactly. Is that
we shot the whole thing on our own dime, all three of them. We went to NYU, we got some debt, this is happening, but we think that our money is best spent on moving forward and you know, pay off those loans later. You know, so we just went into we're not big Kickstarter people, even though Kickstarter is a great platform, and we weren't comfortable asking friends and family because we felt like we hadn't proven ourselves to anyone yet, and we needed to do that on our own. Mouse cost $8,000. Our other short, Valencia, cost $5,000. And Fever, our third short, was shot in four different countries. in Tokyo, Kathmandu, Muscat, and in the US. And that one was just us as crew. It probably cost $2,000 in total.
We were already traveling to those places.
Okay.
So
okay,
that doesn't,
yeah, I was gonna say, like,
that doesn't,
gotta,
yeah, that's a little geez. Misleading
for commercial work.
Yeah. Okay. So that's
like the Fall type of approach, the movie, The Fall. Yeah. That's the way he filmed that.
Oh, really?
Was shooting commercials. Yeah.
Oh, in
you
those places.
Get someone else to send you and then you think of ways to make that worthwhile for your personal.
That's exactly how it happened. Yeah. We knew we were going to be in those countries and we wrote a script to.
We were working with high school students.
Yeah.
So we wrote a script around high school students and then they assisted us on each part, which was awesome. So we were the crew. I did audio. Logan was our DP. We co-directed. And these kids were awesome. And yeah, Fever's doing well too. But yeah, we just thought, you know, if we want to spend money on something, you might as well, I don't know.
The corners we cut were that it was a 16 page script that we only shot in 2 days. Mm-hmm. And we did all of our own catering and we, didn't have seconds. Like we really love keeping crew really, really small in general. And this was our first short that we had a gaffer, and that was like a huge step for us to like enter into the whole lighting realm. That was like a really big
price point. You can tell that you
had
a gaffer.
And for the most part, that doesn't include, post as well too, which can really get I think there's another two grand, honestly, yeah, on top of that.
Logan colored and edited it, so.
Right, which is another way that we can keep it, our costs down.
What is your labor cost like?
It's still free these days.
I think sitting here, now that I'm realizing like how much fell on you two for the film, like I never would have guessed it. Aww. Like after watching it, it's like, not to discount, like I look at you
no,
guys and go,
sweet.
But like, oh, they had all kinds of people, but to hear that you edited and colored and like.
Yeah, no, we did costumes, makeup. We found the location.
Most of the support, like we're very big on, I don't know. I guess we really try to keep everything within our, creative control, and it's been out of necessity because of money constraints up until this point. But moving forward, if the budgets do get bigger, we are still just as passionate about, like, maybe not doing catering, but still, like, you know, like having like a real investment in like costume choices and location and all of that moving forward.
Well, and to piggyback on that, I don't know, my first short was last year and it was $3,000, and
oh wow,
we. Something I've been really loved that I did then that I've kept doing as my budgets grow is, like you're talking about, like doing as much as we can ourselves as possible, just because it's fun and
it's a good way to learn.
Yeah, and like it's like you build a team that way too, that you really trust and that you really love, so that when you do have your budgets grow, there's a certain pleasure in being able to actually start paying people that did it before you could pay them.
If you were like to have an ideal short, you know, like you're looking at maybe one location, like a small cast of people, what are ways that you can ensure that you can actually make your short? Like, do you go into the writing process knowing that you want to keep it, you know, sparse, simple?
All of those things should always, you know, come out of the story that you write, but you also need to live within your means. You know, like we don't go out and start, you know, writing car explosions into our scripts, because on a subconscious level, like we understand that we're not in a place of being able to do that. And I think it's just a healthy balance. It's like, you're always going to come up against the fact that, you know, things are going to cost, money, and you're not going to be able to do them. But that being said, there's a lot of ways to be able to do things really inexpensively, and it is about having that like sort of network, whether you're scratching people's backs and being able to pull favors for people. One of our shorts we shot in your house, you know, which was an amazing short. One of the end scenes we shot in your house. And that kept us from having to drive out into the middle of rural America to be able to find a location like that. And it's just because of who you know sometimes. And so I guess the takeaway is to not like discount any relationship you have with anybody ever, because at some point down the road, they're going to have something that's beneficial to the story that you want to make. So be your best self on like every single set and in every single creative capacity, because all of those favors come back around if you're looking for them.
And it's usually in ways that you don't necessarily think, where it's like for Jillian, our location, one of our locations was her cousin's office. And then another location was my house. And like, you know, it's just, it's not like she hired me because as a producer because I had a house that she liked. It was like she hired me as a producer because we have known each other since film school. And like,
we'll bleep that out.
You know, and I just happened to have a great driveway for what we needed. Like, it's not like she was like, I'm going to hire her for a driveway. Like, but, you know, it's all friends, and it's nice when you work that way. Mm-hmm. Anyways.
I would disagree with what Logan said before. I think that you should never limit. I think you should never limit yourself when it comes to writing. I think the most exciting things, our feature is set in a location that there's never been a narrative feature before. Hopefully we're shooting January 2018, so I'm not going to tell you guys what is bad on here. But yeah, and that's the first thing I ever wrote. And I write usually the first drafts of all of our stuff, and then Logan comes in and we finish it off co-writing it together. And I think that I never want to be like, if a car explosion fits into it, then that's what it has to be. And we have to figure out a way to do a car explosion. If that's all of the budget and then nothing is spent on anything else and everything else is favors, then that's what it is. I don't know. I think it's important to not limit yourself, because if that's what you're, I think it's important to tell true stories, honest stories. Or if you're a midnight short, crazy stories. And if that's what you need, then that's what you need, the story you need to tell.
And I think going off of that, being realistic though is still so much a part of it. And knowing it's like, ooh, this does call for an explosion of a car, but maybe there's a way you can set that up, and all of a sudden you're back inside, and the glass and the curtain comes in, and a bright flash and a bang. It's like, dang, we just made a car blow up, and that cost us like $60 window pane, you know?
There we go.
And some lighting. So,
there's nothing more creatively fulfilling than restrictions in certain ways.
Yeah.
Being scrappy. Being scrappy is the best.
All right, guys. So, just to wrap up here, I'm going to ask you all to give me your best piece of advice for people who are trying to do what you guys are doing right now, which is making stuff that is successful.
Best piece of advice is to try to make whatever is in your head and then show it to a friend and ask them to give you the most critical feedback possible. Or write your script and send that to everybody. Get people's feedback. Be willing to ignore people and not listen to them, but also you have to be open to what they're saying and what they might be identifying. But you have to create, and you have to fail, and then you have to be open to your own failures until you can get something that's like, oh, it's starting to work now. This is great.
I would say I fall into traps of being prejudiced against certain things. I don't want to watch that. I don't want to watch some weird thing on YouTube or something like that. So I would say be open to, you know, consuming media that you may otherwise not be into, just because it unlocks little things here and there in your brain to inform what you want to do and then help you with your voice. I really liked what you said about experimenting to find your voice. So
I think the basis of every great piece is story, and it does start with a script. Like you're just saying, I think it's about consuming as much as possible, and not just in film. I read so many articles. Just read a lot of articles, and I love looking at pictures of the year from like as far back as I can go, because I think that there's a lot of beauty and a lot of stories and a lot of ugly that hasn't been unwrapped yet, and finding that it's not just drawing from, a lot of times drawing from your own life can be the most powerful stuff, but there's something really cool about having to dive into something and do a shit ton of research and figure stuff out that can make you even more excited about it. So I would say just consume as much as you can. And again, don't compromise.
yes to what everybody is, has, that's what I would have said if I had gone first. And so to contribute something new to the conversation, the idea of having a team that you completely, that you feel comfortable being your most artistic with. We've built our crews so far, and there are people that we are keeping and people that we don't want to work with anymore. You know, it's just because, you know, your vision really aligns with some people, or, you know, you feel comfortable, telling someone that they're wrong or having that argument in that moment. And it may not be your group of friends, you know, it may not be the people that you think that it is. But really find that out for yourself and discover, who makes you like your best self when you're in that mode of production.
And I know we just spent a bunch of time talking about how shorts are great because there's low risk, but at the same time there, I mean, it's hard. It's hard work, and it takes a lot of time, and it takes a lot of other people's times, and we're all scratching each other's backs. And so I think my piece of advice is that if you're going to do it, make sure it's something that you really care about and not just something you're making because you want to, quote unquote, be a success. Because, like, especially with this kind of thing, it's like, it's hard. And it is the ones that I've seen that I've loved the most going to these festivals are the ones where you can tell that the person was going to make it whether or not they got into a festival. And that, like, you know, if you don't get into a festival, there's so many great outlets online for people to see your work that there's other versions of success. Mm-hmm. So make sure you're making something you really love.
Yeah, I was at a keynote yesterday and the speaker said, like, you know, if you've made a film, then you are a success. So if you've done it, then you're a success. It doesn't matter what people think or if you get into festivals, because it's a fucking hard thing to do. Continuing on with the subject of shorts, but actually taking a step backwards time-wise, here's a conversation our writer Oakley Anderson Moore and I led with another group of filmmakers who just had their dreams come true in Park City, Utah. Sundance is the ultimate goal for many first-time filmmakers, but that leaves about 9,000 people left brokenhearted. So, without further ado, here's how Rob Savage, Jed Shepard, and Douglas Cox from Dawn of the Deaf, Lyle Corbine Jr. of Shinob, and Jessica Bashir and Charlie Hoxie of Hi-Rat got their short films into Sundance.
There's like a thing in the film industry where you don't get trusted to do something unless you've done something very similar before, and it's so you kind of create your own opportunity. So I had this feature film that I made, and I made it when I was a teenager, but it was just about teenagers. It was kind of quite a low-key Richard Linklater-y relationship drama, which isn't what I want to do at all. I want to do big, bombastic zombie movies and genre movies and all this kind of stuff. So I had this feature, but I was pitching around all these crazy ideas, including Dawn of the Deaf, which we're trying to make as a feature. And everyone was like, yeah, okay, but we need to see some of this that you've done before. So part of the reason for making the short and for just throwing everything into it and trying to make it as big and pool as many resources as possible was about just showing the kind of scale we could pull off, showing that we could nail that genre and then hopefully get the feature made off the back of it.
I just want to say, in terms of, you know, what you were saying, what steps did you take? And just like you were saying, until you've done something, then, you know. And for me, trying to articulate something, you know, to be it a producer, I don't know who, it was almost daunting, you know. Oh, in Ethiopia, hyena, or I don't know, you know. So I just knew earlier on that I had to learn to do it. I had to learn to do it. I had to put myself in a position of empowerment. I have to empower myself. So in a way, that kind of like led me to learn how to and start geeking around camera, you know, and checking out No Film School, you know, trying to learn. Yeah. Trying to learn as much as possible online on, you know, and that's how I learned. That's how I learned to shoot, to operate. And I just decided, you know what, I'm just going to go and shoot this. I have my tripod. I have my camera, and that's the end of it. So, and I'm gonna go, and I have my subject, you know, and that was the best thing for me, because instead of putting me in a place where I'm trying to, I don't know what, I was just doing. So that was very, very important for me.
And like, I don't know if I could add on to that as well. Like, I like massively kind of credit that as like just going out and doing things is like hands down the best way to get anything done. Right? That sounds silly, but it's definitely true. But also like, one of the things that sometimes you miss if you don't go through any of the kind of screen education courses and things is some of these kind of peer groups that, you know, everyone advocates. But there's so many cool people you meet just by process of never refusing to go out for a drink, just sort of answering a phone call, like kind of, you know, replying to an email, replying to a Facebook message, just adding someone, just being interested and doing things. Like, it is like hands down the way you build your network. And like I mentioned before, the collaborators we've kind of grown up with making our films are now really close friends as well. And you kind of, you learn from them and they learn from you. And that's sort of, you know, that's our film school, right? Yeah.
That brings up an interesting point, because it's like sometimes you structure the short to make people feel exactly that, you know, what happens next, what's going to be, you know, the next step in this character's life, or even what can the director of that film bring to us next time. So keeping that in mind, why did you guys create, did you guys create your short in a way to sort of make people think that?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, because originally when Jed brought me the idea, it was like, that's an amazing feature. I've been wanting to make a zombie movie for the longest time, but you really need something quite weird and bizarre to you need to come at it in a slightly different way, and that seemed like it. And I was taking it around and I was pitching it, and everyone was like, everyone engaged with the idea, but there was always this question about whether hearing audiences would engage with a film with entirely deaf protagonists, if it's just going to be a lot of reading, or if it's going to be, if it's going to put the audience at a distance. So the short film was very much a kind of proof of concept for no, this is engaging, this is actually something that could be utilized to kind of to draw the horror out of the scenes in a different way. And it's meant to leave people wanting more. I mean, we're trying to get a feature made off the back of it. So. Mm-hmm.
And in the same sense, you know, it can be used for proof of concept, but it can also be used sort of as a calling card to sort of show your style as a filmmaker. Jessica, did you have any intention with Hirat in that sense?
Yeah, mine was not necessarily proof of concept. I've been going back to Ethiopia over the years, shooting this documentary around Harar. And when it came to shooting the Abba Yusuf story, and we started editing it, I knew it was just a piece on its own. So it's not necessarily a proof of concept, but it's something that does sort of show you a little bit of the style, you know, the voice. And that's how I intend to, you know, edit the longer feature. But it was good to, it's a great experience, because then, you know, 'cause you're also trying out, you know, how it sounds, how it feels, you know. And this one was like, yeah, this is exactly where it's at.
Yeah, so with that in mind, do you guys have projects in your back pockets that you're sort of strategically brought with you to Sundance? If a manager were to come up to you, or an agent were to come up to you and be like, no, this is great, I'd love to see more, do you put yourself in that position where you're like, okay, yes, I have it already, right here, here you go?
I mean, I think you've got to. I mean, you can't come to Sundance without a back pocket script. I think you've got to have the next project, because it's only going to be another 12 months until the next Sundance, and then everyone's going to have forgotten about you. So, you know, so it's lucky for us, because the thing that we're trying to get off the ground is a feature version of Dawn the Deaf, so everyone can see it and they understand what it is and they kind of get the tone of it. So that's what we've been taking around.
It's such a fascinating story, and like, but I think as well for folk like making films, when you really know what you want to say in your story, you put yourself in those situations where when you cross paths with someone and start talking and they mention something, you're like, but that is what I'm trying to say. And so you kind of do put yourself in that situation as well, I think, when you're really clear in your own head about what you're doing in advance of sort of going into it, I think. I don't know.
Oh yeah. You kind of like are open, and you let the world guide you in a way, and it's such an amazing guide, you know. Like the name Hirat, for example, you know, it. When I went to shoot this, I got sick right away, and I was in bed for like 3 days, and I was just like scared. I'm like, oh my God, I'm gonna go back to New York. I'm not gonna shoot anything, you know. So finally, I pulled myself up, and I'm walking around. And and I'm totally sick, and there was a tree. So I went and I sat under the tree, and it happened to be like an abadir, you know? And this imam, you know, comes over and he's like, what are you doing? I said, oh, I'm sitting under the shade. You know, I just needed the shade. And he's like, okay, but no, what are you doing? And I said, oh yeah, you know, I was here. I really wanted to do this, but I'm feeling so weak and stuff like that. And he just looked at me and he said, you don't know anything about Hayrat, do you? Obviously, you don't know anything about Hayrat. I said, no. And he said, you know, Hayrat means everything that happens in your life is happening for you. Everything that happens in your life is for the better. You just have to know how to read it, and you're not understanding. You know, all this sickness is happening for you. Understand that. Go and shoot that. Be very thankful because all of this is happening for you. So, yeah. And I just couldn't believe it, you know, and I obeyed. Like, literally, I just got up and I said, okay, yes, I'm going. And yeah, so this was made with this Hayrat spirit. That's the name.
You talk about how, like, you have the story constantly on your mind, right, when you're making these shorts. How does the short, the format of the short, benefit your story, or any story in general versus a feature?
I mean, I think shorts are good for capturing a feeling or a moment. The nice thing about Dawn of the Deaf is that it we kind of designed it so it felt like a tightening grip, and then it kind of spits you out on the other end. And it's very hard to do that for 90 minutes, and I'm not sure anyone's going to enjoy experiencing that for 90 minutes. But you can do that. You can just really hit a certain feeling, a certain you can just put the audience in one state of mind for 10 minutes, 20 minutes, and then spit them out on the other end.
I think specifically for Dawn of the Deaf as well, the great thing about it being a short is, myself being a massive horror fan, all I watch is horror, really. I'm sick of zombie movies. I've seen just every single one of them, straight to Netflix ones, and they're all roughly the same. So it's really hard to come out with a different angle, and it's really hard to convince someone to watch a zombie. If they know zombies in it, it's already a hard sell. So having it in this kind of like short format, and maybe the kind of the deaf thing is a little bit gimmicky, but once they watch it, they realize this isn't just your normal zombie film. This is about love. This is about society. This is about differences between, little nuances between people, and how we kind of deal with people who are possibly less fortunate than ourselves. And yeah, so you can't really do that in a feature film without having to prove it first with Ashore. So it is kind of a proof of concept.
Yeah, and I mean, I think for us, like we were saying, we're trying to create like a world and a vibe more than anything, you know? And I mean, maybe we could go back and do it feature length. But we're working from the constraint of having no budget and having to like work day jobs to pay rent and doing this in our free time. So I guess that was the main constraint with what we were able to produce. But I think, you know, it was very freeing because our piece is 6.5 minutes. So we're just focusing on trying to grab people for those six minutes, you know, and yeah.
I think I was very gravitated towards this subject specifically because for me, what it talks about is about freedom. It's about not having to ask permission. It's about doing something that nobody does, or who cares if they do or if they don't. This guy gets up every night and he goes to the forest and feeds hyenas, whatever, you know, who cares, you know? He doesn't care. And I love that because I was just thinking exactly about filmmaking. I don't want to explain. I just want to go and do it. I'm just going to go and do it. And for me, that guy, that's what it stands for. He has like his own rhythm and he goes and he does his thing. And I love that.
Yeah. And I guess like in a sense, shorts can be more freeing in that experimental sense as well. I ask this to everyone I interview. I'd really like to hear sort of your best piece of advice for aspiring filmmakers. Something to keep in mind that has helped you reflecting back on your own journey.
The first thing that comes to mind is just, finding your voice and trusting your voice, you know, cause you have to find what unique thing do you have to say? What unique perspective, what unique passions do you have that deserve to be shared with the world? And just trust that you do have something to contribute and stick with that. Yeah.
When you're starting out, make a lot of stuff, make a lot of shorts. The best thing you can do, and I found this out because I started early and I had this film that I'd made and I was very proud of, but there was nothing like anything I wanted to go on to make. And I spent about three years taking this film around and pitching lots of horror movies and getting kicked out of every meeting I was in without a film deal. And the problem was I hadn't shot enough stuff and I wasn't confident of who I was as a filmmaker. And through doing these shorts the last 2 years, it's really kind of allowed me to hone in on exactly what I want to do and have an example of the kind of film that I want to go on to make. And when you're going into a room with the absolute assurance of who you are as a filmmaker and where you want to go in your career, that's the best possible moment you can enter into the film industry. So while nobody's looking at you when you're starting out, that's the best time to figure all that stuff out, make as much stuff as possible. Just figure out who you are.
Yeah, it's easier than ever now to make a short, or you know, you can make anything. You can make a feature like really, really easily these days. So I think people, if they want to get into filmmaking, just to make everything, like make something, make two shorts a year, make three shorts a year. Make stuff that you hate. You know, make if you hate horror movies, make a horror movie. You know, just experiment with everything until you find that thing that you like about filmmaking and that you like your voice. Yeah, find your voice in there somewhere.
One really good thing that you can learn from making shorts is exactly what you don't want to do. You know, I've made shorts before that I absolutely loathe and I'm blushing just thinking about them. But actually, like, I've learned so much more from making those films and knowing that I won't ever shoot in that style again. Or you know, those shorts help you figure out your priorities, and then the next time you step on set, you're much more confident.
I think, yeah, like, leading on to that, like, one of the main pieces of advice I kind of pass on to anyone I meet in life almost is, like, never be afraid of making mistakes. Like, you know, you kind of dive into anything you want, whether it's making a short film or, like, going onto a role on a different film that you want to experience, like, what that kind of role is. And, like, you can make any mistake once and no one's gonna, like, call you up on it. And if you learn from it, that's how you grow as a person and as a filmmaker. And, like, I guess these guys, all this, like, incredible, like, directors and writers, like, as from a producer's point of view, I think one interesting thing is, like I touched on it earlier, is just meet as many other people and peers as possible and chat to them about films, because you learn more from chatting to them, they'll learn more from chatting to you, you'll make things together, you'll fall out, you'll make up again, you'll have a pint, like, you know, it's like, this is a wonderful community to be a part of. You know, it's what's, you know, one of the main things that I find so special about being here at Sundance, and why I feel really privileged to be an alumni here now. And, you know, we're all alumni of each other's films that we make, you know, so... just, yeah, chat to each other. I'm getting really weepy. So
I just want to say, the only piece of advice I would give to someone who wants to kind of come up with some ideas is make friends with the weird kids at school, because they have the best stories, and all the popular kids will have very generic, boring lives. But the weird kids have the sense of adventure and the kind of all the great stories about loss and love and... Yeah,
stay weird. We're all the weird kids here. Yeah.
Yeah. We all very much agree with that sentiment.
Well, I don't know if it's advice, you know. It's just, you know, the route that I took, it's kind of long, you know, and it's a bit lonely, I got to say. And I agree with you in terms of, like, meeting people and trying to talk about, you know, the stuff that you're, you know, belonging to some, you know, filmmaking groups, you know. I think peer support is awesome, because this could be a very lonely and a very weird type of journey, you know. And so I think belonging to, you know, to filmmaking groups, you know, because then, you know, you can see that you're not alone. You're not that crazy. Everybody else is too. So, you know, you feel supported, you know, you feel good about that. And then, and just go and shoot the thing.
Create like a group of 6 to 10 people that you're close with. Like, they could be filmmakers or just other artists who you can send your film to, and they can get your... Like, that's also what kind of saved my film, is getting, like, really honest advice from...
Yeah, from people whose taste you trust, too.
Yeah, exactly.
So, like, trust is something... I'm not going to go on a rant about it now because we're winding down. But in the wider industry, I think trust and faith in filmmakers is something like was spoken about before. It's becoming harder to prove. Mm. And, you know, I completely agree to find a group of people that you trust and who trust you enough to be able to tell you what they think honestly is really key. Yeah, because when you don't go to film school and you have no film school, it is about creating your own peer group, and that's, you know, that's mega important, I think.
And then I'd say, just on the flip side of that, be honest with people. You know, like, if someone's movie sucks that's your friend, don't be afraid to tell them that it sucks, you know, or like, don't be afraid to tell them what's wrong with it.
There's some great Nietzsche line.
What's the, anybody know the Nietzsche line? It's like be a pillow, but like a tough one.
There you go. Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally butchering.
Finally on the program today are some excerpts from a DP roundtable that Liz Nord led back at South by Southwest with cinematographers Autumn Eakin, who shot The Light of the Moon, which won the South by Southwest Narrative Feature Audience Award, James Axel West, who shot Easy Living, and Shane King, who shot The Untold Tales of Armistead Maupin, which won the South by Southwest Documentary Spotlight Audience Award. And while the episode is titled The Shots That Almost Killed Us, I haven't included any of those stories, opting instead to highlight their killer industry advice. Here it is.
Each of your films in its own way has these very intimate moments with its protagonists. Even in the Docs situation, many times Docs, it's even more intimate because it's real life. And as the DP, you all are the folks kind of closest to the subject other than the director. So what's your kind of approach or strategy in the more very, you know, raw personal kind of moments that you're shooting?
Definitely if you can have real conversations with the actor beforehand, especially for this film particularly. Stephanie Beatrice is the lead who plays Bonnie, and you know, it's a very she's a victim of sexual assault, and it's a very intimate portrait. We are following her, you know, for these 6 weeks post this assault, and it's very, very true and very vulnerable. So I think that the production team you know, did a very smart thing and had everyone meet before, like cast and crew and things like that, and hang out and discuss and get a feel for each other. And even with Michael Stahl David, who plays her boyfriend, you know, there are some pretty intimate sex scenes, things like that, where, you know, I also shoot documentaries. So I'm very, very used to asking people to trust me to film their most intimate parts of their life. And I think that if you can connect with that actor as, you know, Stephanie Beatrice and not Bonnie first, that always helps. And just to sort of have a dialogue that I understand what position you are being put in right now. And I'm here for you and I'm here with you. And, you know, that goes a long way to, in the moment when you're in a room, she only has underwear on, the sheet's falling off, you know, whatever. It's like, no, I got you. I'm gonna protect you, you know, in whatever way, whether that means like tilting up a little bit or, you know, not letting, you know, whatever happen. It's just, there's something really important to me about having some sort of conversation before we get to the nitty gritty.
Yeah, I think, like Autumn said here, I think trust is so huge. I mean, with a narrative or a documentary, because, you know, I think I just come in and I just try to be a regular guy with actors. I don't, you know, bow down to them in any way or pretend like I just try to just be a regular guy with them. And I think that helps the director trust me a lot. And I think that helps when I meet the actors. And yeah, there's a lot of intimate scenes in Easy Living. I don't know. I think I'm kind of a quiet guy too. And I think I've heard actors say like, I didn't even know you were there, you know, and I operate myself. So I just try to like, you know, not be there or be, you know, just be really quiet and let them do their thing. And, you know, it's even non, you know, what we think of intimate scenes, but just intimate emotional scenes.
Like vulnerable scenes.
Yeah, anything. I just do my thing. I'm just trying to translate the vision to the, you know, through the camera to the screen for the viewers. So yeah, it's you know, I just don't want to be I think you just have to not be obnoxious or, yeah. You know, I can imagine people out there and it must make actors feel very vulnerable, you know, but.
Yeah. And they're, and also I'm sure there are plenty of people who are making the scene about them as the camera person, you know, if you're operating yourself especially, but. For The Light of the Moon, we shot on Alexa Classic, the EV, and we had Ultra Primes. I think in large part because, you know, I should say that we were able to get a really great package because of people at VER Cinema, which, you know, before last year, probably, I came up as a camera assistant in New York, a union camera assistant. So whenever they said, oh, VER, a different producer had said, oh, VER. And I was like, I think they do like cables and monitors and stuff, right? You know? And they were like, no, they have a full like camera, these huge camera bays. And they're really like going more towards that side of it. They have a bunch of stuff and they have a real incentive to build relationships and to grow relationships. So luckily I had shot a commercial a few months or so before we started production on Light of the Moon. So I was like, remember when you said budget doesn't matter, just like come to us and see. I was like, well, I've got this indie film. And so they really came through. They were really, really amazing. So as we all know here, you know, having a rental house that has your back with that kind of thing, where I'm like, it was almost all handheld film. I was like, I really need a wireless follow focus. You guys get us a Preston? You mind get us a Preston? And they were like, nope. We said, whatever you need, we're going to give you whatever you need. So wow. That was really, really wonderful. And it was, like I said, it wasn't all handheld film. Would have loved to have the mini instead of the classic, but, thank goodness for Easy Rigs. And I can't even imagine. I used to, you know, I'm from like the middle generation where I operated on, you know, 35 Ariel T's and things like that there was no Easy Rig then. And I'm like, wait, why have I ever
those cameras are kind of balanced really well though.
No, they are. Like, and that is like shoulder. You were saying, like the ergonomics, they're made to be handheld.
The newer digital, it's tough.
So you know, whenever you know, that's, they were like, we can't do the mini, we can do this. And I was like, okay, great. So I love that. I love the Amira a lot, especially for some like the more doc style commercial thing that is, you know, very popular now. It's similarly because of the ergonomics, and also just the look, you can trust what you're getting, like what you see in the viewfinder. But I actually own a 4K Sony F5, which is great. I mean, I love that camera. It's kind of like my workhorse, and I can do commercial type projects on it. I can shoot the doc I was talking about before. That's what we're shooting on. So yeah, little workhorse.
Yeah, the cameras you mentioned do seem to be the ones that come up over and over again, sort of F5 on the doc side and the Aries on the narrative side. Yeah.
And thank you for reminding me, I do have to give a little shout out to Video Facts in San Francisco, which as we were shopping for cameras, they, one of the people who works there is a huge fan of Armistead Maupin and has been his whole life, and gave us screaming deals on all the cameras we wanted to rent for that project, and that was how we kind of decided what camera to buy.
I feel like this is a great, you know, tip, you know, unintentional tip too for our listeners, is like, these relationships matter, you know, be kind and generous with your rental folks and they probably will return that.
Yeah, well, I mean, we also bring them money.
Right, exactly.
You know, I mean, hopefully when you can, but not just the producers, but it also helps us. And, you know, when a producer says like, oh man, we really need this kind of deal. Do you have any relationships? And I'm like, actually, I have someone that will stand behind me, which it sounds like you had experienced with Panavision before.
Yeah, I think it's important. I try to tell younger people, like camera assistants and, you know, gaffers and best boys, like, and getting the producers on, like smart producers will pay for the prep days, and you got to get the guys that are part of the show in there to check out the gear. And then even on returns, if you can talk your producer into helping out with the returns, it's huge, because they could bring back a nice clean package. You know, I guess what I'm saying is just don't dump a bunch of gear. Unclean. Yeah, be professional. Don't dump a bunch of unclean gear back in a rental house. I mean.
Well, we always ask advice, and I think I have a two-parter here to wrap things up. One is general, you know, aspiring DP advice, but another is advice for directors about how to or not to communicate with their DPs. So take one or both.
I have an insight that I came up with about being a DP. I was shooting in the Chronicle, working with a journalist, and he like dropped his pencil or something while we were working together. And I was like, oh, I can see you're not a DP. You obviously work with the written word and not moving images. And it occurred to me, I was like, I bet there are no clumsy DPs out there. So that's a word of advice to an aspiring DP. If you're clumsy, find another career, because you have to be physically capable to do this job.
That's very true.
Yeah. I mean, you have to like really long hours, little sleep. It's just, and grueling conditions. I mean, as you've heard here, I think, yeah. I mean, I get excited about it, mm-hmm. and want to do it.
And I think that helps on that note, it helps if you can find people that you collaborate well with and that you admire what they do or how they do it, or, you know, their style, whatever directors, you know, their style or something. That's what makes that stuff possible, of like putting up with the hours, with the travel, with the whatever, is hopefully you're collaborating with people and creating relationships with people that you want to actually make things with. And I think to directors, especially if you're aspiring, you know, I mean, I always will probably, when I'm 65, still consider myself like an aspiring DP, because there's many layers, many more tiers to it. But I think if you're especially an aspiring director and then working with a DP who tends to be one of the more experienced people on, you know, like indie sets or whatever, I think, you know, have a lot of conversations and feel secure. A lot of times directors will get defensive and intimidated by the DP, thinking that, and I'm sure maybe some DPs are just jerks, but intimidated by what the DP is actually doing, is helping you and collaborating with you, and not trying to take your spot or take over your role. It's really like, that is our job, is to collaborate with you and use us for what we're supposed to know, and we use you for what you're supposed to know and do, you know, and to not, yeah, it's a collaboration, and that's supposed to be a good thing.
That's great advice. Anyone have anything to add?
Yeah, I think, so if I was to give advice to young cinematographers, I would say the keep it simple thing, and which can cover a million things. So I'll say one thing for keeping it simple is don't try to add lights to get rid of shadows. If you shoot something with one light or two lights, great. Don't worry about a single shadow. You'll never light a shadow. Shadows out of your frame. I just see it a lot with young people. So, and then my for people that are, for directors, up and coming directors, I think maybe one thing is commit to the shot. And then just do the multiple takes. Don't change something in the middle of doing a shot. Because what always happens, it winds up getting cut together. Like, I've seen it where they change props or they want the DP to change the lighting. And you have to be careful because once you start shooting it, they might want to cut both those things together and it just kind of becomes crazy. So once you commit, I almost think of it as like signing off. Like you sign off, okay, we're going to shoot this. Take one, take two, take three, take four. Minor adjustments with the actor, but the set is kind of locked. Unless it's something major. But
yeah, like have faith in your vision. Like you put a lot of, hopefully, put a lot of prep work into creating this world, you know, in that particular shot or that particular scene.
I mean, it's never perfect for a cinematographer because we have this thing called the 90% rule. If you're 90% there, shoot it, you know. Don't try to keep, you'll never get to 100%.
Yeah, and I would say, I mean, as a DP, my biggest frustration with working with directors is just not having some time up front to kind of plan things out, like just expecting to be able to show up on set and be handed a storyboard or have no storyboard or you know, just no discussion of what things are going to look like. And they, you know, they give some kind of vague reference to something they want it to look like and then trying to scramble together and make that happen on the fly, where like a 1 hour conversation the day before or a week before would have made it really easy to execute.
That's such a good point. I think there's this idea that like, oh, well that DP is really talented. So they just like walk in and can do anything. And yes, they may be talented, but that odds are if you're referencing this person, they have become someone to be referenced because they've put a lot of prep work and the director and the producer and all of that. They understand the importance of prep.
Right. They know what piece of equipment to bring in order to make a certain kind of shot happen.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been there before. They're just like, just hit the record button. Ugh. And I don't, you know, I'm not a diva in any way, but it's cinematographers, I think, are kind of like actors. You know, you kind of just need to know, where am I, you know?
Yeah, what's the story? What are we doing here?
When they say stuff like, that's happened to me before, they're just like, just hit the record button. And I'm just like, okay.
Boy, that's offensive.
Yeah. So just a follow up on that.
Yeah, you hit a real good point.
Well, that's all she wrote on These Puppies. I hope you've enjoyed listening to the past couple weeks' worth of interviews, half as much as I've enjoyed taking a trip down memory lane and revisiting them. Here's to a ton more great new content in 2018. To make sure you don't miss out on any of it, subscribe to the No Film School podcast on whatever podcast platform you so choose. And if you so happen to so choose iTunes, go ahead and drop us a nice little 5-star rating. I'm John Fusco. You can follow me at @Jim_John_Jim on Twitter, and No Film School is @No Film School. We'll see you next week at Sundance.